This is an interview with Arthur Levitt for the SEC Historical Society Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation, June 20, 2013, in New York City. I'm Kenneth Durr. Thanks for taking some time to talk. I want to start by going through your background a little bit. A lot has been written about your father and the fact that he was some kind of an inspiration to you, certainly. But I want to go back a little bit further to growing up in Brooklyn. Did you have any exposure to the securities industry as a young person?
Only that my immigrant grandfather told me that stockbrokers were crooks and not to be trusted. Did you read my book by any chance?
I did indeed.
Because I touched on this period in chapter one.
Yep.
But that was my earliest memory of the stock market. It was reviled, it was dishonest, it was filled with cheats and plutocrats, and it was a socialist's notion of what our markets were.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed as my mother, who was a school teacher, became concerned with the value of her pension and my father, who became head of the Board of Education, also began to think about retirement benefits. And when he became state controller, the notion of protecting the pension system and the benefits of the pensioners was almost obsessional and trumped every other consideration, political or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
The politicians were constantly importuning him for different areas of expenditure, and he fiercely defended the rights of the pensioners.
Now, while your father was doing that, you were moving well along into adulthood, and your course took you to Williams and an English degree. I'm wondering what your aspirations were at that point.
I had none. I was a drama major. I loved theater. I did honors work with Lillian Hellman, the American playwright. I worked for the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsfield. I applied to Yale Law School and was accepted. Then I went into the Air Force, and during my time in the Air Force, I didn't seem to have a passion to be a lawyer. And I had an uncle who was a very famous publisher. He published the American Weekly, which was a Hearst magazine. And he was married to Ethel Merman, and he made $62,000 a year. And I thought if I could make $62,000 a year, I'd sign that contract for the rest of my life. So he said he'd introduce me to someone at Life magazine. And they accepted me into their training program, sent me to Cincinnati, and my job was to go around to the stores in Cincinnati, tire stores, department stores, jewelry stores, automobile supply stores, drug stores, clothing stores, jewelry stores, and persuade them to put up signs of products that were advertised in life.
Okay.
And it was so discouraging because so many people turned me down that I tendered my resignation after 4 months, and my manager, who came from Detroit, came back and said, look, hang around. You filled out cards on each of these people you called on. Pick the 5 toughest ones, and every day go back and call on them again and do it for 30 days. And I did that. I became immune to failure, and I became a great salesman.
So I know that you went through selling cattle as
Well, what happened then, I was transferred back to New York, working for Time Magazine now in their public relations department.
Okay.
And if I was successful at that, they might offer me a job as a space salesman, which was the ultimate. And indeed, they did offer me that job, and it paid $12,500 a year. I said I couldn't afford it. And a friend of mine was married to someone in Kansas City who headed up a cattle company, and they were willing to pay me $25,000 for selling cows in ranch land.
Mm-hmm. That must have been quite a switch from working for life.
Everything I've ever done in some way or other prepared me for the next step.
How did that prepare you?
It brought me into contact with very well-to-do, successful executives at a level that anyone my age could never possibly approach. And it brought me into contact with people in 15 western states, ranchers and cattle growers, another dimension of society that I could never otherwise have been exposed to. And doing this for 5 years, eventually somebody that I sold cows to said, if you can sell cows, you can probably sell stock. My son-in-law is starting a brokerage firm. Would you like to join him? And there's only one job in my life that I've been offered that I've turned down. Every other job, no matter how remote, I accepted. So I said, sure, I'd love to be in the brokerage business. And I joined a firm called Carter, Berlin & Weil, knowing nothing about it. And I taught myself the business.
Tell me a little bit. Describe that firm. Place it in the larger sort of terrain of Wall Street at that time.
They were tiny. They had we had 5 partners all seated in the same room, about an equal number of staff people, analysts, and secretaries, and small space at 60 Wall Street. And we did research, which wasn't done very much in those days, and we underwrote small, unheard-of companies. And I started the syndicate department. Syndicate department is the department that gets into deals, goes to Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and says, look, you're doing an underwriting, give us a certain number of shares and we'll sell them, we'll make money. And we were looked upon as a non-entity, a new firm nobody had heard of, so I had to do a lot of persuading.
How'd you do that?
I just called on people that I knew, many of whom I knew from the cattle business. I was persistent. I was also a stockbroker building up a book of clients, all five of the senior partners. Sandy Weill was one. Roger Berlin, who's the most successful producer on Broadway today, was one. Arthur Carter was another partner. And it was a tough environment. They were very competitive guys. We all had eventually equal shares in the firm. And we made many acquisitions. We changed our name 11 or 12 times while I was there. I was president of the firm. Sandy became the senior person in the firm, even though we owned equivalent amounts of shares. Arthur Carter was forced out of the firm, and eventually Sandy prevailed in getting rid of just about everybody.
What was the competitive advantage that you had? You were small. You were small. But you're going through these acquisitions over the years.
We were small and we were agile. We made an acquisition of Hayden Stone. We got the New York Stock Exchange to fund that acquisition. We were around at the right time. We had pretty good research. We developed good relationships, and we survived while everyone else was failing. We were small enough not to have built-in costs and systems that were redundant and costly.
Okay. Now, sometime in here, you started to get involved with the Amex, if you understand. What was your first relationship with the Amex?
I met the chairman of the Amex at a dinner where I sat next to him. Paul Colton was his name. And we bonded. And shortly thereafter, he asked me if I'd be willing to serve on the board. And I did that for about a year. And the Amex was going through a lot of problems. They had just introduced options, and there was a scandal involving the specialists. And the specialists bitterly resented Paul Colton bringing a case against them. And the Attorney General of New York, Louis Lefkowitz, bringing a case against them. So it was apparent that Colton had outstayed his term there. He was a very able, thoughtful, decent guy.
He wasn't a broker, though, right?
Mm-mm. Came from the New York Stock Exchange and a background in public relations. So I was appointed to head the nominating committee to find a successor to Colton. And I felt I was a pretty logical successor. So I resigned from that committee and let them choose me. So there I was, head of an exchange that was dead in the water with a terrible reputation, a floor that was bitterly opposed to management, to the compliance people, totally fractured. And I decided we had to build a new image for the institution. And the Business Roundtable represented the largest 100 companies in America. Nobody represented the high-growth companies of America. And Bob Strauss suggested to me that we set up such a company. And he suggested the name of a guy to run it. And I started what was known as the American Business Conference to represent the fastest growing smaller companies in America, most of which were listed on the American Stock Exchange. And that got a lot of traction. They were all too willing to meet us in Washington. We scheduled meetings every year, mostly with the president or the vice president and other cabinet officers. And I would bring down specialists from the floor, listed company CEOs, and they'd say, gee, being on the Amex really gives us something. We don't get that at NASDAQ. We don't get it at the New York. So we built quite a presence. We made them feel better about themselves.
Kind of made a virtue of something that had been understood as a liability in the past.
And, you know, my political skills were awfully important at that stage of the game. I knew that to succeed, I had to have avoided the hostility of the floor. So I went down to the floor every day. I befriended them. Some years before that, I started going on outward bound trips and then began to develop my own outward bound trips. And I would invite members of the board, floor brokers, listed company CEOs, and we'd go down the Colorado River, the Chattooga River, and I'd bring cabinet officers or congressmen. And again, all this was to promote the image, the growth, the excitement of a small institution that represented high growth companies. So I was probably the most successful chairman of that institution in history. And I stayed there for 12 years.
Was there ever talk of a merger with the New York Stock Exchange?
Many times, and I participated in those discussions, but they really regarded us as fourth-rate citizens. And I had testified before Congress the first time in 1959 when I was with the cattle business. I had a long history of dealing with Congress. And certainly my years at the Amex, I was constantly dealing with members of Congress and helping introduce our companies to congressional committees. During my last year at the Amex, I bought the congressional newspaper.
Okay.
And I also agreed to serve on the base closing commission. And a year before that, President Carter made me head of the White House Conference on Small Business. And again, I involved CEOs of Amex companies in that project.
Why the roll call acquisition? It seems like an interesting lateral move.
Very interested in politics. Knew it could be a power base with Congress. Thought I could make money on it because it was a nondescript, once-a-week publication. And it was enormously successful. And again, built a following for me. Everything I've ever done in my life helped me with the next step. So, base closing commission, where I met congressmen from all over the country who didn't want their bases closed. The newspaper, which they cared passionately about. My own credibility in terms of heading a then more prominent business group and an exchange. Having worked for President Carter, President Reagan appointed me to a cost-cutting commission. I've worked for every president from Carter right up to the present president in different capacities. Mm-hmm. So it was time to draw that career to an end. And, oh, while I was at the Amex, the chairmanship of the SEC came up. And I very much wanted that job.
Is that when David Reuter retired?
Yeah. And I had a lot of Republican support. Howard Baker interviewed me. I was told by many Republican politicians it would never, ever go to a Democrat. Bob Strauss helped me, but indeed, everybody knew it was doomed. But I did get into the final round. And then I guess John Shadd got it.
Okay.
So that brought me to the end of my career at the Amex. I decided I'd stay in the publishing business, and I bought a series of community newspapers and magazines. And Bob Rubin asked me if I would participate in a fundraiser in New York for Bill Clinton, whom I'd never met. And I said I would, and I did. And Clinton was elected. I didn't think much more about it until a story appeared, I don't know, February, that I was under consideration to be chairman of the SEC. And I got a call from the White House asking me if I would accept, and I said, of course. And they said, you'll hear from the president. And I waited at home for 3 days and heard nothing. And 6 weeks went by and I heard nothing. And then at one of our periodic American business conference, which I was still chairing, in Washington, we were to meet the president. I thought, now I'm going to find out. So we met with the president in one of his offices, and he went around, with about 100 of us, went around the room, and when he saw me, he reached his hand out. Arthur, that's a beautiful tie you're wearing. That was it. Another few weeks went by, and the White House personnel asked me if I'd want to allow the FBI to do a check? And I said, sure. That went by another 6 weeks. And they said, yeah, the president's going to appoint you. You'll hear from him tomorrow. I didn't. He sent out a press release. And I didn't meet him for some months after that. So I was then appointed. And the next 6 to 8 weeks were damn important, maybe 4 to 6 weeks. Mary Shapiro was the acting chair. And I had to get up to speed in terms of what I wanted to do and how I could define myself. Arthur Lyman, who was a very successful litigator at Paul Weiss, was very helpful to me. He said, you have to define yourself with your staff. If they support you, it will be hugely helpful, and if they don't, you're doomed.
How did you go about doing that?
I spent an inordinate amount of time with every key staffer. I met with them. I went to their offices. I counseled with them. I really waged a campaign to win them over. I spoke about them at every opportunity as patriots. Underpaid, overworked. I did everything humanly possible to build confidence in them. I fought for their increase in salaries. I really went on a campaign to win them over. I included them in every conference I had. They made me look much smarter than I was. Markets have, you know, chairmen look smarter or dumber than they are because of markets and luck. Luck plays a huge part. David Reuter had bad luck. Mary Shapiro had terrible luck. I knew the Congress. I liked them. They didn't intimidate me. I dealt with them for too much of my life. I must have spent a third of my time on the Hill. So when the House turned over, it didn't bother me one single bit.
Yeah. Let's back up a little bit. That's a key moment, of course. But looking at the industry and at the markets in 93 when you came in, you know, you talked about winning the staff as being important, because without that, there's nothing else. But what was the situation in the markets? What did that lead you to make your priority, what you wanted to accomplish?
We had a corrupt municipal market that was an Oriental bazaar. It had been that way for years. We had accounting practices which were abysmal. My first move was to try to do away with pay for play. I determined that my commission was going to be known from start to finish as the Investors' Commission. That every one of our constituents, the markets, the corporations, the accountants, the lawyers, second place to the investor. Every speech I gave, every meeting I had, was geared toward enhancing the role of the individual investor. I fought a well-publicized battle to get the industry to back away from pay-to-play. And that was the first success I had.
Had you been aware of this for a long time, pay-to-play?
Yeah.
So
I watched my father's campaigns. I watched what happened there. I saw how New York State gave out business. As a salesman, I was importuned by communities to buy tables at fundraisers as a key to getting underwriting business. I knew the business.
So you started off with kind of a voluntary approach, and you worked with Frank Zarb on that. Tell me a little bit about that approach.
Frank Zarb helped me a lot. He went around getting companies to agree to sign on. And pretty soon we got most of the major underwriters to sign on to a voluntary ban. And then we codified that.
Was there pushback when you tried to write it into rules?
Yeah, some firms pushed back. Eventually they came around. Phil Purcell pushed back from Morgan Stanley.
It would seem like in the arena of public opinion, it would be awfully hard to come out against it.
I know it. Though. And it gave me a terrific platform. A huge amount of press. Now, for the chairman of the SEC, the ability to be comfortable with the media is critical. My God, had I had experience dealing with the media, the American Stock Exchange, constantly, from my own experience as a reporter, and I liked reporters, and I liked the media, and I was good at it, and I knew it. So that was very helpful. How do you really brand a commission as the Investors Commission? And how do you keep Congress off your back? I said, let's go into the community and have town meetings where investors can voice their concerns, talk about how they were being disadvantaged, how they needed the help of government. So I called for a town meeting in New Jersey, and we had 20 people. I spoke about the markets, I answered their questions, and I saw instantly we had something here. And we began to have town meetings all over America. Now, a typical congressman rarely gets more than 100 or 200 people to a town meeting. We began to draw over 1,000.
What kind of people would come?
I'd partner with a local newspaper and they'd promote the hell out of it. Individual investors. They'd line up in front of a microphone. This is what happened to this investment, or what can we do about these commissions? And I brought a member of my oversight committee, a congressman, who couldn't otherwise get a forum of that kind.
Hmm. Which one was it?
I brought them all.
Oh.
I developed great relationships with my overseers. And that tended to keep them off my back and be supportive of me. So we operated on a lot of different fronts. We succeeded in branding the commission as the Investors Commission with every initiative that we followed. We followed that up with waging a strong battle for better accounting standards. And I was blessed with a phenomenal staff headed by two wonderful chief accountants, Walter Schutz and Lynn Turner. Accounting issues became an obsession.
Let's start into that. And I gather that the opening salvo was expensing options and the FASB, FASB. Had that been in the works before you even came to the commission?
Yes.
Give me a little background on where that was when you took it up.
Well, FASB was sort of pushing for it. And when I entered the lists, I saw that it would break FASB apart and bring down the wrath of the business community. At that stage of the game, I didn't want to lose that battle, and I felt there were too many other issues more important, and I backed away from it. Probably made a mistake in backing away from it then.
Was the staff behind that decision, or were there people pushing to keep on?
No, they pretty much went along with me. Subsequent to that time, I picked it up again and fought for it more successfully. And by that time, we had Warren Buffett supporting it and others supporting it. I knew that SEC chairs could be destroyed by taking on agendas that were too broad. And I wanted to focus as much as I could on issues that I could succeed with.
Okay.
Now, I was being called to testify maybe every 3 or 4 weeks, constantly, on every conceivable kind of issue. That took an enormous amount of time, and I was having to... Another issue that I made a major point of was getting more money for the staff.
Right.
Fighting for... using the revenues generated by the commission to keep them at the commission. And I knew it was a losing fight, but I believe that there are fights worth losing to engage in, and that was one of them. I also relied very heavily on my predecessor, Richard Breeden. I spoke to him nearly weekly. He was smart and tough, Republican. And he was the first one the media called when they wanted to know what kind of a job his successor was doing. The accounting issue was probably the most contentious issue and lasted till my final days at the commission. I remember one of my key staffers, Greg Corso, put a screensaver on the computer behind my desk which said, accounting issue, accounting, accounting, accounting. Hmm. A commission chairman is defined not by the rules or the regulations that he passes, more often than not by the speeches that he gives, by the quality of his speech writers, who can take ideas and put them into brilliant words and quotable sentences. It's kind of a Wizard of Oz job. If you're going to be intimidated by the Congress and just sit behind your desk and deal with the papers and deal with your commissioners, you'll have kind of and if you have calm markets, you'll have an indifferent experience. But if you really want to define yourself, pick a few issues, give some really meaningful speeches at meaningful centers of intellectual thought. And whether you pass the rules or get this through is irrelevant.
How about the issue of brokers and analysts? That was something that you looked at early, too. Was that one of these things that just sort of happened, or was that one of the issues that you chose to focus on?
What do you mean by interest?
Well, basically, the fact that you put a lot of attention on the fact that the analyst side of stock brokerage firms were beginning to drive the the brokers to make sales that were not necessarily in the best interests of the investor.
I didn't spend very much time on that issue. That really came after me with the Elliott Spitzer.
Okay.
I was more interested in compensation, that brokers were incentivized to churn.
Okay.
And I'd given a speech while I was still in the brokerage business at Columbia called Profits in Something. You really ought to look up that speech. Because it drove Sandy Weill crazy. I said that brokers should not be incentivized to churn accounts. And I made that a major issue. And I also, again, as the investor's champion, I knew from my experience that the NASDAQ market was cheating them, that it was a collusive market. How the hell could I get them to straighten out without having them call for my impeachment?
Them being NASDAQ?
Yeah. I talked to them, got no place. I finally got the Justice Department to bring a case against them for collusion, and that's all I needed. It was collusive. You go out for a bid on an over-the-counter stock and 20 of them came in within fractions of one another. And I forced them to their knees.
So, was this independent of the Christian Schultz, I guess it was, the two economists who did the study about odd eights?
No, that wasn't independent of them. They certainly motivated the Justice Department to move ahead.
Yeah. But I guess the obvious question is this something the SEC should have caught, the odd eights stratagem that they were using?
You know, should the SEC have, who knows? They've got so much on their plate. What U.S. attorney or what regulator ever catches something before it actually happens? But Christian Schultz certainly played a huge part in that.
Do you remember hearing about that?
Yes.
Did a bell go off, or what was the response?
Again, if I was there alone, it would have sailed right over my head. But I had an incredible staff. I had Rich Lindsay, who was head of market regulation. I had Carrie Dwyer, who was my deputy, who really knew market structure. And we just ran with it. And I met with the Justice Department. I'm trying to remember the name of the senator's wife who was head of the Justice Department division that helped bring this case, Bingaman's wife. This was a big deal. We fought with the firms. They resisted. We finally had a meeting at the commission. Dan Tully, the head of Merrill Lynch, was negotiating for NASDAQ. We argued for hours. And finally they consented. And that was a big, big win. It transferred billions of dollars a year from the pockets of brokers into the pockets of investors. And it made possible the order handling rules, which gave rise to the new kinds of markets that we have today and the issues that we have today. No commission in history ever did more with market structure than our commission. I can't claim credit for that. I had Rich Lindsay and I had Carrie Dwyer, who were the real architects of that.
But the NASDAQ scandal opened the way for that, yes. It sounds like. Once that happened, you had, conceivably, there were two things. One is essentially, punishment, so to speak, or what's the penalty for doing this? And two is, how do you restructure the markets? And some of the contemporary, press thought that the punishment was too great.
It wasn't great enough.
Yeah.
I think the punishment was just fine, and it led the way to dealing in pennies and decimals, which is still a debatable issue, but I think we're on the right side of that issue. And viewed from the investor's point of view, the name of the game is increasing the speed of transactions and reducing the cost of transactions. Now, all the time, I had the harassment of Congress on my back, constantly.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about something that you hinted at before, which was the 94 congressional elections. Did that make an immediate, did that cause you to sort of change your strategy very quickly?
No. If anything, I had better relationships with the Republicans than John Dingell, whom I liked a lot. I worked this. Steve Largent was a great star of the Oversight Committee. I held a town meeting in Tulsa. I stayed overnight at his home. I played golf with him at his golf club. I really worked this. And my closest friend in Washington turned out to be Phil Graham. We didn't agree on anything except Labrador Retrievers. And he thought he was playing me, and I thought I was playing him. And we were both playing one another, but he could have made life miserable for me. If I tried to objectively look at what made my tenure a very successful one, I would say it was at least 55 or 60% luck. I had good markets. I had commissioners that weren't so ambitious. They were trying to undermine me. They weren't doctrinaire in terms of ideology. I understood how to deal with the media, and I understood how to deal with the Congress. That's pretty potent.
Yeah. And it sounds like the administration certainly wasn't on your back, to say the least.
I had 25 political appointees, always of the party of the president. 13 of them were either Republicans or independents, and the White House gave me every single one. When I had trouble with the Congress threatening to cut my budget because we were proceeding against the accountants, the president let it be known through his counsel that he would veto any bill that did that. I was consulted on the appointment of any commissioner. I couldn't have had better support.
Okay. How often did you meet with the president?
Never.
Okay.
And during his final days in office, he invited me to meet with him. And I said, why is it that I've brought cases against people in the administration. I've embraced issues which embarrassed you. You treated me like a postmaster in Little Rock. he said, with you and Reuben and Donna Shalala, I knew you knew your business. If you screwed up, I would have fired you. He was a great president. He respected the independence of the agency.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the politics, legislation, which is inherently political. Some of the things that came at mid-decade following those congressional elections, and I just want to get your recollections on the process.
It was a sad day in 94 when the Republicans took over. I was at Roger Altman's house, and everybody was so tremendously depressed. We quickly adjusted to it. I mean, the ability to deal with change is just a life lesson. And I've seen it in business. I've seen it in academia. I've seen it in government. And I was so intrigued with politicians and politics that I kind of looked forward to it. I spent more time with the new Republican leadership than I might otherwise have done. I'm trying to remember who preceded Mike Oxley. It was a guy from Texas. And we got to know one another very well. And with Mike Oxley, I played golf with him. I really worked this territory and loved it. Absolutely loved it. Now, during this period of time, I had a congressman try to destroy me. David McIntosh, a right-wing Republican from Indianapolis, was convinced that I was cheating the government. And he felt that I was using government funds for personal purposes.
Oh, that's the airplane thing?
That was part of it, that I was traveling first class, even though I paid for it myself, that I had taken a trip to Israel for a foundation and charged it to the government. More importantly, I was going to New York on Fridays to visit the New York Stock Exchange so that I could be near my home in Connecticut. And he got Lisa Myers of NBC to put a program in the works called The Fleecing of America. They sent a boat off my house in Connecticut to photograph it. They sent a camera crew to Paris to film me getting into a limo, which I paid for myself. And they were all, and my wife said to me, "You got to get out of here. I can't take this." It was profoundly upsetting. And I hired A.B. Culverhouse, the managing partner of O'Melveny and Myers, at my own expense, to defend me. And he got a young partner named Joe Lombard, who subsequently came to work for me at the SEC, to go through my records. Meanwhile, NBC was filming away. They were all set to go. And Joe found an American Express chit which showed that I had paid for that Israeli flight and trip. And then Holman Jenkins, who I hadn't known, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, wrote a piece saying how outrageous it was for the Republicans to criticize someone for paying his own way to go first class. And the event disappeared. And that created a bond between me and Holman Jenkins, and a bond between me and Joe Lombard, who's going with me to Alaska in 2 weeks. And it got that episode off my back. but it could have destroyed me just as it destroyed so many, and it cost me close to $400,000 personally.
Wow.
In legal fees.
Okay. The kind of thing you have to expect, I guess, in that situation.
Maybe so. And so I was better able to afford that Washington experience than many. And the environment, I think, was still less poisonous then than it is today.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the legislation. The Securities Litigation Reform Act was the first one. And on that one, that had to do with class actions and that sort of thing. Tell me a little bit about how that played itself out in the SEC.
I dealt a lot with Abner Mikva at the White House. My staff worked on it. It was an issue that, not being a lawyer, I didn't know enough about. And the importance of small words really didn't register with me the way it should have. And Chris Cox was really leading the fight for that. I didn't fight it as aggressively as I should have. I don't regard it as one of my finer moments. And I really believe that a lot of the problems that the Commission has today is a function of the liability standards being so rigorous in terms of bringing actions.
Was the SEC able to temper the legislation at all?
Modestly.
Okay. But that wasn't something where you really chose to throw down the gauntlet.
No, and I think that Clinton's veto was, you know, at the wrong moment.
Yeah.
I don't know why he did it the way he did it.
And NISMIA, that one would have been less contentious, I guess.
Tell me again what NISMIA was.
That's the Securities Integration, National Securities Markets Integration, came about a year later, where you're basically looking at essentially allowing large issuers to register with the SEC and not worry about state regulation.
Yeah, I think that made a lot of sense. I was a great supporter of the importance of states, but also recognizing the costs of redundancy and regulation. But it certainly was part of my experience there that a company with a problem and didn't come to the regulator came to the Oversight Committee to harass the regulator, and they couldn't care less about whether the regulation was correct or not. If their patrons in the business community said it was costly, and if their patrons were campaign contributors, their mission then became to provide the regulator with as much difficulty as possible in getting that regulation through. It's an unfortunate way of doing business.
Did you have your allies that could help you fight against that in Congress?
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about the care and feeding of those folks.
Well, the Democrats generally were supportive. I had Dingell and I had Markey. They knew more about securities issues than most members of Congress that I had dealt with. And then with the Republicans, my job was to try to just keep them from being too troublesome. And I really became very friendly with the two heads of the Oversight Committee that succeeded John Dingell.
Well, let's move into the later period in the SEC and a couple of very big things. One would be Reg FD.
Yeah.
Let's talk about where that came from. Was that generated by the staff?
Probably Harvey Goldschmidt was important. I think Matt Winkler of Bloomberg came to see me on it. And I instantly became convinced it was the right thing to do. Harvey Goldschmidt was hugely important to me for every one of my years at the commission and for every one of my years subsequent to that up to the present moment. He's been a compass for me in terms of what's right and what isn't.
So how did you proceed with that, with Reg FD?
Full speed ahead. There was no ambivalence about it. The industry opposed it on the way into the final commission meeting on it. I had a call on my cell phone from Hank Paulson from China saying, Arthur, if you do this, you're going to ruin the business. I said, I'm sorry, Hank, we're going to do it. I had lunch with Hank a year and a half ago. And he said, Arthur, you were right more often than I. Which is really the mark of the kind of a guy he was. So we got Reg FD with a minimum of difficulty. Was it perfect? No, no rule was perfect, and it needed lots of trimming, and we were willing to do that. Harvey Goldschmidt was hugely important.
Now, is he the one who sort of turned this from an insider trading issue to a communications
yes.
issue? Tell me a little bit about those discussions, because that's a really interesting turn.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember how that transition worked.
But Goldschmidt was leading this one.
Yes.
Okay. It sounds like it was relatively easy to do, but my understanding is a lot of voices were raised with Reg FD.
I got a number of corporate leaders who really observed the principles of FD to state that they're the notion of FD was consistent with their what they regarded as good governance.
Could it have gone farther than it did?
Sure.
And was that something that did you start with sort of an ambitious agenda and scale it back to meet political requirements?
I can't recall that.
Okay.
Are you talking to others about this period?
Oh, yeah. My colleague just spoke to Harvey Goldschmidt the other day, I believe, and it's something. I talked to Laura Unger quite a few years ago now. She did a study of Reg FD, I think, after, you know, a year out or something like that. Mm-hmm. The idea was always that it would chill communications.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever see any indication of that?
No. Although companies would argue that.
And did you take that, did you, you know, think, well, maybe it'll happen? Did you sort of investigate the possibility at the time?
When I'd made up my mind that this is something we were going to do, I tend to focus on that.
Okay. Well, another thing you focused on was auditor independence.
Yes.
And this took you through toward the end of your time.
It really started early on when I saw that the FASB was controlled by the industry. and I waged a very contentious battle that I won to get balance in the board of the FASB.
How did you do that?
I told them that we had to have independent directors, or the commission simply wasn't going to recognize them. And what was Mike's last name who headed Deloitte? He was the head of the FASB, and he became an ally in getting this done. Lynn Turner can fill you in on a lot of this.
Okay.
Have you spoken to him yet?
I think we spoke to him a long time ago, yeah.
Is this going to result in a written document?
There'll be a written document, yeah, up on the web and the sound file, yeah. We have basically an archive of historical materials, including all these oral histories online, that's used by scholars and people interested in the securities industry.
Does every chairman have a section? Is that what?
Basically, all the oral histories are arranged alphabetically. They can be accessed alphabetically. And so there's chairmen and staffers and other folks from the securities industry.
So I'm being quoted. What I'm saying to you is going to appear as a quote?
Yeah, it'll be all in the full context. And you'll get a chance to look at the document once we produce it. Well, picking up on auditor independence, and you talked earlier about speeches, and you know the big one appears to be this 1998 speech at the numbers game.
Yeah.
Did you know before you gave that it was going to roil the waters a little bit?
Sure. I did.
What was the intent there?
To gain national focus on what I regarded to be a national scandal.
Was the staff working?
Off the record, I don't think there has ever been a more definitive, more important speech given by any chairman of the SEC than that speech.
Well, let's talk about why. Talk about the result. What happened after that speech?
Well, it gained great notoriety, and it formed the background of the commission's commitment to try to squeeze out practices that were against the public interest. It rose the question of auditor independence to a higher level than it had ever been before. And it became the launching pad of the effort to separate consulting services from auditing services.
You're really talking about building public support
for
this outside of the government. Okay, so having created that backbone, what was the next step?
The next step was to negotiate with the firms to get rid of their consulting practices.
Was this the Blue Ribbon Commission?
Well, eventually it was, but more important than that, I felt this had to have national traction. We had Congress. It was being lobbied fiercely. So how were we going to get public attention? What better way than having public hearings? The accounting profession so bungled this in allowing it to happen there they sat, meetings in different parts of the country for hours, defending a practice which was indefensible and which could have been handled in a private forum from their point of view much more effectively.
Did you give them that option?
No. They could have had it. But they were pretty bellicose. And they fought it aggressively. But their performance at these hearings was abysmal.
So then the Blue Ribbon Committee.
I think the Blue Ribbon Commission, my recollection was, it dealt with, not auditing, it dealt with governance standards.
Okay, right.
Had nothing to do with auditing.
Okay.
It dealt with what are appropriate governance standards. What's an independent director? What isn't?
Okay.
So it had nothing to do with...
That's a subject that I'm particularly interested in, is corporate governance. Now, was that an issue that you were particularly concerned about during your
yes.
time? Tell me a little bit about how that played itself out.
Business is filled with conflicts, and corporations, in my judgment, operated in an environment of fraternity. Boards were fraternal, and boards should be skeptical, not confrontational, but skeptical. But the boards were chosen by the chairman. They met relatively infrequently, and board independence was a major protection for individual investors. So the Blue Ribbon Committee was formed to come up with standards of board behavior that would be embraced by the New York Stock Exchange. I might say parenthetically that I'm not totally convinced that good governance necessarily leads to good performance, or that poor governance leads to poor performance. I've seen too many exceptions to that.
Right.
But in any event, this was a useful exercise because the fraternalism of American boards, I think, worked against the interests of investors in terms of keeping from them information that was important for them to have, keeping the balance between the power of the board and the power of the shareholder unequally balanced in favor of the corporation.
Did most of this focus on the idea of an audit committee?
No. An audit committee was important, but board structure was an important part of it.
Can you give me a little more on what the outline of the idea was?
I can't recall all of it.
Okay.
It was followed by, and you ought to look at this, the conference board
mm-hmm.
had a study on governance that I was part of.
Okay.
It really proved to be a template for what good governance should be.
You were looking at boards. What about shareholders? What about shareholder access, things like that? Was that an issue in this period? I know it became one later.
Yeah, I mean, shareholder access to the proxy was something we looked at but didn't proceed very much with. International Accounting Standards. We recognized early on that we had to have some kind of convergence. Phil Graham wanted it to be immediate. But it was apparent to me that different sovereignties had different cultures. And total convergence was probably impossible. America did have the most rigorous and transparent standards. So we had the notion of appointing an international commission to come up with standards. And the group that worked on that brought me a list of names of people that should be part of that commission, and they were names that you and I had never heard of, practitioners. And I said, this won't do. We have to have a group of people instantly recognizable internationally for probity and integrity. And I'm going to get Paul Volcker to head that group.
Was that a tough sell for Paul Volcker?
It was tough, but I got him to do it. He's been a friend of mine for some years. And even he would say that we're moving too slowly. But our standards are still so much better than anyone else's that the process has got to be a very meticulous process.
Well, I want to finish just kind of with some big picture things. And one is, you know, it appeared that at least from your discussion of your process of coming in, that the administration left the SEC well enough alone. But from what you've said, it sounds like Bill Clinton was at least watching to see what was going on.
I think so.
But the challenge, you had this ongoing challenge of, you know, basically a budget that wasn't moving very much while the tasks you were being expected to accomplish were. Tell me a little bit about how that affected the commission and
I don't
your
think
management
at all.
Of it. No?
No. I think that it's how you use the money rather than the amount of the money.
Okay.
We had all we could do to use the money that we had. We didn't really lack funds. Sure. I would like to have paid people more. We were way behind on technology. That wasn't the issue. I think that's the major reason for having self-funding is to provide higher compensation for staff. But the staff is there not for the money they make, but because they really believe in investor initiatives. Now, we spent a lot of dough in investor education that had never been done before. Uh-huh. We spent money in terms of bringing municipal bond cases, which the Tower Act really impeded us from doing, but we brought those cases anyway.
having served the longest as a committee or as a commission chairman, what would you say that the one lesson that you learned would be? You talked about through every stage of your career, you learned something that took you to the next stage. What did you learn at the SEC?
How do I answer that? There's no one thing I learned. It played every one of the skills that I developed throughout my life. It's such a multifaceted job involving political skills, media skills, ability to take risks, and lots of luck. I was probably the luckiest chairman in the history of the commission.
Well, that's a great note to end on, unless there's anything that we haven't talked about that you think we should.
I'm sure there is, but you can come back to me anytime you want.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.